Cambridge 105 Radio.
Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves.
Scientists are all looking for ways to detect and deflect COVID-19. And the more work that's done in this field, the better for all of us. Professor Cecilia Mascolo, who is a professor of mobile systems at the Department of Computer Science and Technology at Cambridge University, is working on a mobile system which aims to detect whether people have COVID-19 purely by listening to them talking, coughing, and breathing.
And former Cambridge Georgia Business School online communications officer Georgina Shoshana Cohen has quite a different goal now. Her mission is to become the first ever female skeleton athlete competing for Israel to qualify in the Winter Olympics, and her target is Beijing 2022. Professor Cecilia Mascolo is at the cutting edge of research into machine learning, devising programs which enable computers to act intelligently when dealing with data. Cecilia's work has recently been focused on a project called COVID Sounds. Linda Ness talked to Professor Cecilia Mascolo.
Cecilia Mascolo is a professor of mobile systems at the Department of Computer Science and Technology at Cambridge University. She's also a fellow of Jesus College. Cecilia ranks in the top 100 computer scientists in the UK, and in 2016 was listed by Networking Women as one of the 10 women in networking communications that you should know. She is co-director of the Centre of Mobile Wearable Systems and Augmented Intelligence. Cecilia has a particular interest in the study of mobile systems and in machine learning. Her recent research on audio-based mobile health diagnostics is leading to the ability to detect COVID-19 by the sound of your breathing and coughing. Thank you very much for joining us on Women Making Waves today, Cecilia.
Thank you for having me. That's a great introduction there.
Was I correct when I was talking about that last bit about the COVID-19? You want to be able to detect COVID when someone breathes, coughs, talks?
Yeah, talks. I thought your introduction was almost complete. We are hoping that voice also has some characters and features that we could recognize for COVID diagnostics. So it's not just the coughing, it's not just the breathing.
That's really interesting. Let's come back to that in a little bit. Let's start at the beginning. Let's go back in time. When you were young, where were you brought up?
I was brought up in Italy, in Reggio Emilia, which is a city close to Parma where they produce Parma ham and Parmesan.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Is it quite a big city?
Similar size to Cambridge, really.
Yeah. Okay, nice. Were you geeky as a kid? Because I'm kind of assuming you're a little bit geeky with the job that you do. Were you like that when you were young?
I like my books and I like my math. I guess at the time we didn't have, that reveals kind of my age, but computers were not something you would have in your house when I was very young.
Oh, so, me too.
Yeah, define geeky, but I did like my books.
You did like your books, and you were into science, presumably.
Yeah, I actually had an encyclopedia with planets, and I was looking almost every day at the planets descriptions, and was fascinated by that.
So maybe a little bit geeky for girls at that time, presumably. It's always interesting to find out what people were like when they were younger, and you can start to see how they got to where they get to. You came over to the UK quite a few years ago, I think, to London initially. What drove that move?
So I decided to start my PhD in Italy, but after a while I realised that I wanted to explore abroad because collaborators were abroad. So during my PhD, I went for 1 year to the States, to the Washington University in St. Louis. And then while I was seeking for other opportunities, I came across other opportunities in London. So I went to UCL as well. So it was part of my PhD initially, and then decided to stay. And I've been here ever since, moving around from London to Cambridge.
What was your initial degree in when you were studying in Italy?
Computer science.
In computer science.
Yeah, the interesting bit of computer science in Italy is that it was a spin-off from maths. And maths in Italy is a degree that people take if they want to go into teaching. So we actually, because of this chain of things, we had 50-50 women and men in computer science, which was very comforting at the time, very, very comfortable.
That's quite interesting, actually, because I would have assumed that the majority would have been men in computer science, actually. It seems to be very much STEM subjects have, in the past, were very much male-dominated.
It was the case that the information engineering, which spawned off from engineering, was a male-dominated subject. But the particular degree in computer science, which was a little bit more linked to math and theoretical at the time it was born in Italy, was from maths. And maths is the subject that you would study if you want to teach in high school. And many women want to teach in high school. So, yeah.
Was that originally your plan, teaching?
Yes.
Yeah.
My mom was a teacher, and that was the closest thing I had as a profession I possibly could have liked, and turns out to be close enough because I'm still teaching.
Yes, of course, of course. Now, obviously, your job is very technical. Most people have heard about artificial intelligence, and my understanding is that machine learning takes the data and enables the computer to learn from it. Is that correct?
I think at the high level, this is correct. I would agree with that definition.
How did you get into that particular field? Because it's quite niche.
So my interests have always been in applied computer science, so trying to understand what we can do with computer science. And so I've worked with lots of disciplines through this, and this is the beauty of computer science. I work with architects, vets and zoologists, psychologists, psychiatric doctors, and now more and more doctors. So social scientists too. And in those cases, when you apply computer science, the first thing that they have is this big question that you need to try to answer in the discipline. And often the step in between is having data from mobile systems and information computer science systems that need to be interpreted. And that's how I got there, because now we have tons of data from these devices and you need to interpret them to make sense of them so that you can advance the science with other disciplines as well.
So is your approach going out and seeking requirements and then developing something, or do you develop something and then look for, in other words, do you find a solution and then look for something to apply it to? Or is it the other way around? Do you listen to vets and other people and go, okay, we'll go back to the drawing board and we'll try and design something around what you need?
I have a few interesting stories around this. I don't think I can give a single answer. There have been a few cases where I had an idea, a technical idea of a thing that I can do and that I had no use for. And I started talking to colleagues. And in one particular case, we started talking to neuroscientists. So I Googled around and found a couple of neuroscientists, emailed them. They happily talked to me. And one of them, and this happened twice, but I'll tell you this story. He listened to my idea and listened to what I was doing, and then suggested that he had a better idea given what I was doing. And we came up with a much better idea of things to do around neuroscience and the use of technology for Alzheimer's disease diagnosis, for example. So it can go, in some other cases, some people knowing my general area come to me with their problem, their domain science, and say, oh, can you solve it? In which case, it's more of a matter of going from the idea down to what technically we can do to solve it. So I guess it could be both.
That's really interesting, because I always wonder what comes first, you know, the technical idea or the requirement. But it sounds like you work together with people, and sometimes it can work either way.
It can work either way, and I think I have examples. But I've thought a lot about this problem. I think it can be either. Yeah.
Now, well, lots of us use Fitbits, running devices, and things like that. Where do you see the future of wearable devices when it comes to our health? Do you see a pathway forward? Do you have a a nirvana that we could work towards that would be absolutely brilliant?
So I think we'll see more and more of these devices, and their precision and their prices will be driven, prices will be driven down. Precision hopefully will be driven up by experience. However, I don't think we're quite there, and we kind of have gained the trust of the users in most of the cases. In some of the cases, you know, the tracking of our heart or the tracking of our sleep are still very approximate. They can give an indication, but they are very approximate. But we can do so much better. But I think there is a lot more that will be done in future years, also because, you know, healthcare as it is, once scale, we'll need to get help to do the simple things more automatically so that doctors can be freed and do things that only people can do. And those, I have no doubt that there is space for doctors. I don't buy in the idea of artificial intelligence substituting our clinicians. It's not going to happen anytime soon. But I hope in a future where these will be instruments that they can use and they can help, can get help from. And I think that's my dream.
So the day could come potentially where we are wearing various things about our body, which we might not think about too much. And then you get a call from the doctor saying, a bit worried about you because we think that your blood sugar is too low, or that whatever, your heart rate has been too high for the past week. That's something that we could potentially be doing in a few years' time.
I think I don't like the idea of a doctor being allowed to prompt you that way. I would prefer, in fact, that the data about you stays close to you so that perhaps a machine learning or something that is less personal could tell you, this is what I found. If you want, contact a doctor. And that's more of an acceptable position that I would accept. I wouldn't like this big brother, my doctor sitting there looking at my data without me knowing. And
you're right.
I think we don't have to compromise on that.
No, I think you're right. People are very worried about that kind of thing, aren't they? The COVID Sounds project, that does sound really, really interesting. Tell us more about that. We mentioned it at the beginning.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about that. We are looking for users, so I'll first describe what it is and maybe we can advertise it and hope that people can contribute their data on this particular project. So the fact that coughing, breathing and voice could be indicative of disease is something that has been determined by clinicians in many pathologies. The fact that perhaps having the data of this kind and automatically apply technology such as machine learning to do this diagnosis is something that is already happening again for some of the clinical pathologies. And so our idea is we have launched this data collection. Essentially, it's an app that you can install on your phone and would ask you a few questions about yourself, your symptoms, as well as your medical history. It also asks if you have tested for COVID, because we could use that kind of ground truth data. And then it asks you to contribute your coughing. So we ask you to cough three times into your phone, to breathe a few times into your phone, and to read a sentence that we display on the phone on the screen. And then this data comes back to us. And at the moment, we have collected more than 9,000 users' data. And we are trying to apply machine learning to see if we can distinguish COVID-tested patients, users, from people who are healthy. Yeah, that's the basic idea. At the moment, the more data, the better, because obviously being this crowdsource, we often have samples that are noisy, that are not useful. So we welcome data. If you go on covid-19-sounds.org, you can find all the information and the apps that are available on Android and iOS.
It's utterly fascinating. And it sounds to me, when I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, wow, this could be huge because, okay, COVID's the big thing at the moment, but potentially if your voice, if you're breathing, if you're able to detect illnesses, could that be, you could detect when somebody was going to have a heart attack, or you could detect other symptoms?
So I am not the only researcher working on this. There are a few researchers who made quite advanced steps in trying to do that. A colleague of mine, University of Washington, Shyam Golakota, has a paper out where he's using 99991 in the US calls data and he has analyzed those calls, and he is able to detect features of heart attacks, agonal breathing, which could help in this sense. So yes, there are other researchers working on this. The main thing is having data. The data we are collecting through the COVID project also has a medical history, ask people if they suffer from other illnesses. So in theory, if we are lucky and collect a large data set, we might be able to study other respiratory diseases through the same data set. We also ask users to send data every couple of days. So one interesting aspect of this is progression of disease. Not many people would have had the data to do this in large scale like we do. And we hope to look into that for COVID, but also for other diseases.
This non-invasive way of detecting illnesses just sounds amazing. It sounds absolutely brilliant. What's a day in your life like? In the position that you're in, Cecilia, what's a normal day, or is there not a normal day?
is that pre-COVID or post-COVID?
Let's talk about the moment. So at the moment, which is, you know, very, very different, I guess. What's a day like?
So in terms of types of things, it's probably very similar. I'm at the moment, I'm deputy head of department until mid next year, which means I also have a number of meetings related to the running of the department and helping people use the department better. As you can imagine, with COVID, we had all sorts of questions related to how we run the department, let people in, and how we do exams. So there's a lot of that happened during the week, or has been, and meetings too with my team. So I meet the researchers in my team, each of them once a week. And we have a group meeting once a week, and we are running a seminar series now because of COVID. We don't have to invite the speakers to travel. We can run a seminar series with lots of speakers from all over the world online, and it's going really well, I think. So I try to always keep some time to work. So it's not meeting all the time. There is perhaps a morning where I have lots of meetings, and then an afternoon where I read and consider and write papers and do the things I need to do, and time for the mind. I like running, so I try to run 3 times a week, and I do some other exercises because this is something I've introduced because I was cycling to work almost every day, and now I don't do that, so I introduced some more gymnastics and aerobics things at home to complement, because if I sit all day and in front of the screen, it's really bad.
It's a real problem. I'm finding that's a problem as well, actually. I've been going out for walks at lunchtime and in the morning before, because I tend to be sitting in front of a computer the whole time, which is really bad for you. Really bad.
And the thing that changed from COVID is that because I'm home, I have a family. I have a 17-year-old daughter and a partner. And, you know, we now lunch together, which means that we also need to eat at lunch, which means I have to prepare lunch. Oh, some of us have. I'm not the only one able to do this, but yes, that's the additional thing.
Do you not find, though, the quality of life has been quite nice since we've been kind of at home? I've really enjoyed that aspect, actually. No travelling and just having... I've got far more time. I don't know about you. I've been doing more cooking and stuff like that.
I've always liked cooking, but I do like working from home. I always did keep 1 or 2 days at home. The fact that there are more means that I need to complement it. Not moving. I don't like not moving, so I've added movement, more running, and more exercise. But I do like my home and working from home, and meeting my family for lunch is something that I find very, very nice.
You were saying earlier about the online seminars and the fact that you can actually get a lot more speakers and a lot more people involved because there's no traveling. Do you think that's something that we'll maybe learn from and do more of going forward? I kind of hope we do.
Yeah, I think this is here to stay. I don't think we will change that. It's so good. And I think, you know, the difficulty is that usually when we invite a speaker, they would have a chance to meet one-to-one with some of the researchers. This part, we will have to work towards finding a replacement for. That is completely lost at the moment. We usually, we have group rooms, but it's not the same.
It's not.
The talk itself, I think, is fantastic the way it is. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's some aspects of the changes that we've had to rush in at short notice that have been really, really good. But you're right that the human relationship does suffer a little bit. You work with lots of PhD students. Do you see, I know I touched on this earlier, but are you seeing more and more women coming into STEM subjects?
Well, my experience is since I started working more and more towards applications, I've seen more and more women come into my group. So I don't know if the bias is simply the shift that I've made or the fact that there are more women around in the subject. I hope we are training more women, but I think we still have a problem in primary school regarding STEMs in the UK, certainly.
Yeah. I wonder what could be done about that. Is it something to do with getting girls more interested in the subject earlier?
I don't know. I've seen it on my own daughter, and I don't know what it is. Maybe the science, perhaps the lack of role model is impacting here. There are very few, you know, they're coming through, but as there are very few, then of course this percolates. And then who is teaching computer science? Well, mainly it's men. Mm-hmm. So that kind of doesn't help. I think we are reinforcing that concept more and more, I think it's still a big problem.
But your 17-year-old, is she interested in science?
Science, yes. She wants to be a clinician, a doctor.
Does she?
Computer science, absolutely not.
Oh, really?
No, that's a no-go.
Yeah. Sometimes the problem is if the role model is the mother, it works in the completely opposite direction. My daughter has no interest in doing radio work either.
Yeah, it might be it. She's a people person, and she really would like to be a doctor. That has a mindset for a long time. She had this.
Cecilia Mascolo, thank you very much for joining us today on Women Making Waves, and good luck with the COVID-19 project.
Thank you very much for inviting me and having such an entertaining interview.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed talking to Professor Cecilia Mascolo. I thought she was fascinating. The work she's doing is absolutely phenomenal. I love the fact that she's working on apps which we can wear, which are for our health. I love that whole idea. But of course, the fact she's also working on COVID sounds at the moment, that is phenomenal, because that's really it's the thing of the day, isn't it? It's impacting all of us. We all can't wait to have immunity to this awful illness, but also to know if we've got it. I thought I might have had it earlier in the year. I'll probably never actually know, you know.
But no, you're right. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I think this whole new phenomenon, though, is app isn't new to us. I think everyone seems to be getting into apps now more than ever before. But there is that element of what Cecilia was talking about precision and pricing. And I suppose the more this app becomes much more intuitive and much more gaining a bit of knowledge and everything, more people want to use it, because this is the way forward, isn't it? We need to be tested. We need to know where we are. So the tracking part is quite crucial.
You can download the app. And what they're doing at the moment is they are researching. So they're putting this thing together. It's not working just now. They're still building it. But they need thousands and thousands of people taking part in this in order to get a database of what the thing might sound like and see if they can find common features, I suppose, in the breathing, in the way that people are talking. But they need to analyse all of these voices. So I would urge everybody, actually, if you're listening, to go along to the website covid-19-sounds.org, and you can download the ARP from there. It's really, really simple to do. All you have to do is upload short recordings of coughing and breathing and report symptoms so you can help the researchers, and it will allow them to build this amazing app. But you were right. What she was saying about wearable technology is she just sees it getting better and better. This is the more commercial apps, I suppose. They will just get better and better, and the price point should, of course, come down.
Yeah, and as you say, it is free and it's worth doing. We're all used to these apps now, and my own son as well has absolutely enjoys analysing his sleep. And I think that's I think it's a really important thing, isn't it? Now, if we've got the equipment, we've got it on our phone, it's really easy to do. We should be absolutely helping this whole research into making sure we are really much more aware of COVID-19.
Yes, and let's not be afraid that people are trying to steal our data when you're taking part in these health initiatives, because that's not what they're trying to do. They are trying to make things better for everybody. And let's all stop being a little bit paranoid about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And the whole point, I mean, one of the things that's come out of this awful pandemic and lockdown is the technology has just gone from strength to strength, and we want it to work for us. We want to be able to use it in the best way that helps us. So this is fantastic. Really lovely to be able to listen to Cecilia today.
Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
So, Susie, you're into your winter sports. You like your skiing and whatnot, don't you?
I do, yes. Mm-hmm.
So how do you fancy lying on a tree, going head first down a very fast icy rink?
Oh, I could do it. Not, actually. I would never be able to do that. I think Georgina Shoshana Cohen is an incredibly brave lady. We had a really lovely time talking to her, did we not?
Yes, we did. And she's really into this sport, isn't she? It's called skeleton, and it's effectively lying on a tray, going down these rinks at breakneck speeds.
And she's absolutely dedicated to this sport, isn't she?
She is, and she's hoping to compete in the Winter Olympics in Beijing in 2022.
She is an amazing lady, and we hope you really enjoy this interview that Linda Ness and I, Susie Thorpe, did with Georgina Shoshana Cohen.
Fastest, trickiest track in the whole world, which is Whistler in Canada, home to the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. Yep, so reaching speeds, I think my top one I ever reached was 133.8 kilometres an hour, which is approximately 85 miles an hour.
Today we meet Georgina Shoshana Cohen, who is an online communications officer for Cambridge Judge Business School. Her other role is an international skeleton athlete competing for Israel. And her mission is to become the first ever female skeleton athlete to qualify for the Winter Olympics, and her target is Beijing 2020. Georgina was the first female to compete in the World Championships for Israel. Welcome to Women Making Waves, Georgina.
Hello.
Very nice to have you here. How did you get to be a skeleton athlete?
Oh, well, this is probably the most fun part of the story. It was my dad who introduced me to the ice sports. At the age of 50, he decided that it would be a great idea to take up bobsleigh. If you think Cool Runnings, it's when there's an ice track and people run, you're either two man or four man, run as fast as they can and jump in this rocket kind of thing and throw themselves down an ice track. And my dad started doing this at 50 years old. I went along to watch him one day in Norway, in Lillehammer. I kind of got inspired, I guess, by the sports, met some amazing people, and a couple of years later I was offered to get on a sled in 2014. That was the first time I had a go. My dad knew the forces very well. Skeleton is bobsleigh's sister sport. It's the one where you, instead of going down in the rocket, you go down on a tea tray and head first with your face inches off the ice. And one of his friends from the circuit was a coach and said, we've got a spare sled for a week. He coached the Navy skeleton team, and I had a go and I was instantly hooked. And then they invited me back like the following year, and they kind of adopted me for a few years, and I got really close with the forces teams.
How did you become so instantly hooked? What was so appealing about it?
Oh, goodness. So there's so much to skeleton. I think the first time you ever do it, I've never felt so much fear in my life. It kind of hit me just before my coach said, like, it's time to get on the sled. And I had to climb over this ice wall into this ice track that's concrete. You know, it is so hard. And I walk the track and to have a look at it. And they say, OK, you're going to be up here, like, 3 or 4 metres on the flat of this wall, like, you know, going round this corner at 60 miles an hour. I think that suddenly hit me as I was told, just lie down. And then I thought, well, I've not had a go at this. You can't stop. But then I did it and he let go, and the sensation of speed and almost having to let go of control was absolutely amazing. And then I finished in this 40 seconds, because you only go from like corner four the first time you do it. You still hit about 50 or 60 miles an hour, but going up the finishing straight where it slows you down, you eventually come to a stop, you just get this huge adrenaline burst. And obviously I had some of my friends waiting at the bottom, and having such a good experience that first week with the camaraderie and everything with the Royal Navy Skeleton team was probably what pushed me to keep going, and having that invite to go back and to be a part of that team. So I just kind of progressed as an amateur, and year before last I bought my own kit, which enabled me to kind of start doing it more as a solo athlete. And then last season I was recruited by Team Israel.
And those skeleton, the actual kit that you have, the tea tray as they call it, that was quite an expensive piece of kit, wasn't it?
Yeah, the skeletons, they're quite hard to get hold of. There are only a few, I guess, brands in the world, and mine's an entry-level competition sled, and that set me back 6k I think the beginning of last season. Wow. So yeah, it's made of, you know, the outside's fiberglass. And then inside you've got, it's nicknamed the skeleton, well, it's called a skeleton, nicknamed a tea tray, because of the inside of the sled looks a little bit like a skeleton. So you have plates inside that look like shoulder blades and hip paddles where you steer with your shoulders and your knees. The middle part, there's a saddle. So basically two pieces of metal come up and like kind of case around the middle, and that's how you kind of grip onto the sled. It kind of holds you in and you hold on to it as you're going down. That looks a bit like a rib cage, so hence the name skeleton.
And not a break in sight.
No. Nope. The only thing that you think about is how do I go faster? So even the tape is aerodynamic that we use. So yeah.
Just thinking about going head first down an ice track. Do you close your eyes when you go down?
Well,
is that what you would do, Susan?
Yep. Yep. I just wish and hope something happens at the end.
Yeah, I have done before. You're not supposed to. So generally you don't like tend to get into trouble. So you're supposed to keep your eyes open. Where you look can help you steer a little bit. So every movement of your head can help change the airflow, which is all about aerodynamics, and like kind of looking where you're going is really critical. But not only just so you can see where you're going, but like to try and help direct you. You do hit a wall occasionally and like get into some hairy situations, and I think that you do close your eyes a little bit, but it's not recommended.
And when, presumably you have fallen off a few times, is that a horrible experience?
Oh dear. I think that the fear of falling off is worse than actually falling off, for sure. I think every time I've fallen off, it's because I've done something really silly. First time I ever came off was on a really, really difficult track. I did it in one of the easiest corners. I was like, how did that happen? But yeah, like this year, like progressively it's got a lot less. So that's really good. And one of the things when you fall off actually is you're not supposed to let go of your sled, because it's more dangerous to like let go of it than to hold on to it. Yes, it hurts a bit. You get bruised, but you just kind of slide around a couple of corners on your belly and then stop.
We've established that when you were younger that you played football in primary school. You've done boxing.
Yeah.
You go against all the stereotypical moments for women, which is fantastic. It really is in your blood, isn't it, sport?
Yeah.
So when you tested out skeleton, I suppose it was the most natural thing for you to do because you loved it.
Yeah. Well, I think I do like adrenaline sports. I guess that's probably
one thing. You like speed as well.
I do like speed.
Now, at the moment, you lead a double life. You work at the Judge Business School, and then after work, when do you start your training?
You'll find me in the gym after work pretty much every day. So I do strength and conditioning a couple of times a week. And then, so that's like lifting weights in the gym and trying to improve my explosive power. All of that then goes towards the start. So that's summer training. And then I do a couple of sprint sessions a week too. And then obviously in winter, I aim to go abroad and to slide. But as for things like diet as well, it's really critical to look at. It's something that I want to progress more with. So when I was out in Whistler for my training stint in January through to March, you know, I got a chance to be really close to other professional athletes. And that's something that, you know, whilst I can't have gluten or dairy, whilst I like them, they don't like me. You know, my diet's genuinely very healthy, and you know, I've done a lot to make sure that I'm the best athlete that I can be.
The life of an athlete is really important to follow a certain diet, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's almost as equal as the training, the physical training yes. that you do.
Yeah.
And it's very important now because of all the doping testings they have. You have to be really on it.
So, for instance, I can't just nip down to the pharmacy and buy some Lemsip because, you know, it's classed as like a performance enhancer. So you do have to check out what's on like the legal drugs list, and I buy all of my supplements from specific websites that are certified so that you don't get caught out.
Do you know what, on social media I love the fact that you're using hashtags like fast and female.
Ooh,
and women in sport and things like that. That's great actually, because you're really advocating women in sport, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. I think that one of my goals as an athlete, like whilst I'm competing and training for this huge dream, is that like I do want to be part of the changing perceptions of women in sport. Things are changing in the right direction. Like I go to the gym and I lift heavy weights, and I think that there is still kind of some stigma against it, and that like girls shouldn't lift weights and things, or what's perceived as a woman's sport versus a man's sport, and that works both ways.
Have you experienced the sort of resistance to women doing certain sports or doing
weightlifting
or
so? I think that it's more the perception of what it is. So boxing's a really good example. It's like I had so many comments of, why are you doing boxing? Like, you've got a nice nose, or like you don't want to mess up your pretty face. And it's, oh, that's not cool. So skeleton, I think, is quite a gender neutral sport, and I do really like that. And one of the positive things that have happened recently is that previously it was for the Olympics were 30 men's spot and 20 women's spot, but they're changing it for the 2022 Olympics so that it's equal. So it's 25 men's spots, 25 women's spots. And, you know, I think that's a really good step in the right direction.
Are you brave, do you think, Georgie? Do you think you're very brave?
Brave or stupid?
No. No, I would answer your question and say you are extremely brave.
But
would you perceive yourself as being brave?
I think that before I did skeleton, no. You know, for instance, I don't really like roller coasters or things like that. I think that with skeleton is a huge element of mental challenge and getting to the start line, and you're staring down this track that's going to take you for an absolute ride, and you're going to try and get down, and you've studied it, you've practiced, you've done everything you can, you've got to go and try and execute everything within inches on ice, hitting speeds of 80 miles an hour. And I think that the kind of preparation that's gone into that, the answer is absolutely yes. Like, and I will keep pushing myself. You know, you come across challenges that are surprising, and you just have to take it on and do it and get over it.
And your family, we've already ascertained that your dad's obviously very sporty because he's into bobsleigh. Is it a thing in your family? Have you a history of your family being really interested in sport?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, throughout my whole family, we all love sports. So I've grown up with my mum horse riding. My granddad on my dad's side, he was Jewish, and they lived in India at the time, and he competed in the Indian hockey team, and he qualified for the Olympics, and he was going to be going, but they were in Berlin during Hitler's time, and the Indian hockey team, they didn't let him go because of the dangers there were to Jewish people at that time.
Mm-hmm. That's very understandable, actually. They were probably doing him a huge favour, really.
Yeah. So he did contest it, and he really wanted to go, but the end result was that he didn't get to go, which was very sad for him.
The suit that you have to wear for your skeleton outfit, how tight or how uncomfortable is it? Because it looks uncomfortable.
Yeah. So my superhero suit.
Superhero, is that what you call it? I love it.
The actual name of the style is called the Avenger. So first time I got into it, it was a bit of me jumping up and down in the living room hoping it was going to fit, but then it did fit perfectly. And I think that there's such a cool feeling, like a nice feeling, when you get into your race suit, because you have your training suit, you just feel fast. The suit's not very thick, so if you hit the wall, like it does hurt and you do get ice burn, but it does take kind of, it's all aerodynamic. Every single thing that goes into skeleton, you have to see, is it going to make me faster? Some of the suits that people wear are so highly engineered. The one that I wear is as well, but at the moment I haven't got a suit that is like specifically fitted for me. You know, that's on my shopping list.
Is it difficult to go to the loo when you're wearing that?
Oh yeah, you definitely go before you get changed. I always have like a very good routine of like, you know, going doing my warm up, but you know, going to the bathroom before putting on my suit is always on the list.
You are looking for sponsorship at the moment, aren't you? Because you are trying to get into the Olympics, the 2022 yes. Olympics.
Yeah. Gelatin is it's nicknamed Formula One on ice. So it's definitely not cheap sport. The investment in the equipment that you can put into it is going to help you. So far, I've self-funded, but I think that the most important thing that I can give myself over this next season is time on the ice, time to train and to really like dedicate and commit to the sport. I was being so lucky so far that the business school have been extremely supportive of me, taking all my annual leave to compete in the European Cup last year. But whilst I was working out there, I was working online, and I've been really lucky to have that opportunity. I think that the road to Beijing 2022 is, you know, just getting started. We've achieved so much so far, but you know, sponsorship will enable me to afford the right support, the right equipment, ability to dedicate as a full-time athlete and to invest in competitive advantages. So sled development, new technologies and private coaching. So these are all things that at the moment I don't have access to, and costs on season on the ice. So track fees and training, but also off the ice during summer to be able to train and concentrate on being Georgie the athlete is exactly kind of what it would go towards. I'm looking now for corporate sponsors and individuals who might be interested in supporting me on the journey.
Lizzie Arnold recently had her tea tray, which is what you use in skeleton. Yes. She had it made by the F1 team McLaren.
Yes.
If you had an opportunity to have a tea tray made for you, which team would you choose?
Oh, which one would I choose? Ferrari, just because it sounds fast.
Yeah. Ferrari tray, nothing better.
Yeah. I think that's a really good answer. So if Ferrari's listening,
yep,
we hope that they're going to come. I'm going to hashtag them, I won't do it now. But if
can
they
I
are
have
listening,
a blue one?
What, not pink?
Well, actually, this is fantastic. Georgina Shoshana Cohen, thank you very much indeed. Skeleton athlete, we hope you do fantastically well. The next 5 years, 10 years.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to chat.
You're listening to Women Making Waves.
Let's talk about my week.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's the point, isn't mm-hmm. it? We're here to talk about you.
It is.
So you've taken a week off mm-hmm. to have a picnic.
I have.
I've never heard the likes in my life.
I know you haven't. I know. You've given me jip actually last week. I was mm-hmm. questioning my own plan, thinking, oh, maybe it's going to be over the top for me.
Well, you take anything that I say seriously. That's
true. That's true. I don't actually. Anyway, I do like my picnics. So much mm-hmm. so, I've got some vintage picnic baskets.
Is this like the Famous Five type thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Have you got lashings and lashings of ginger beer?
I knew you were
going
to ask that. No, I don't really like, yeah. I don't like ginger beer. Cy does, but I don't. I'll just mm-hmm. have a glass of white wine.
I don't remember Enid Blyton ever having lashings and lashings of white wine.
No.
But I think things might have ended differently with the Famous Five if she had.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Yes.
We've now got to worry about face masks, haven't
yeah,
we?
Yeah. Oh, I love all those YouTube films of people making up their own face masks from socks. Mm-hmm. I love all that. Oh, that's the other thing about face masks. No one has mentioned this. Absolutely no one has mentioned the downfall of face masks. For me, anyway.
The downfall?
Is the lippy. I can't wear lippy anymore.
Why don't you mm-hmm. get a white face mask?
You mean in paint?
And paint on lips with lipstick on, and you don't have to bother.
No, it's not the same thing. My lips are nice, you see, and I want to show my lips.
Yeah, well, you can make them even nicer on the front of your mask.
You mean put a mask
on? A big
on.
Grinning, grinning face. Underneath, you can just be as snarly as you like.
Is that what you think of me? It's a big grinning face.
No, I don't. But I'm just thinking it would be quite funny. I don't know why people haven't actually engaged with this and made masks into expressions. I mean, it's a great opportunity to do that.
It is. It
is. You could make yourself look fabulous.
I think
you?
That will happen, though, Linda. Now that we have suggested it, things will happen. Rather, you've suggested it.
I think a big grinning face
or maybe a bit of a pouty face. You could change as your mood changes.
But don't you think this whole thing about wearing a face mask is that you will not be able to see women pouting lips anymore? And, you know, when they're trying to mate with men in the pub and they
mate.
Can't... when they're trying to make eye contact... And they usually, sometimes don't women sort of sprout their lips? No, not sprout their lips.
Well, they certainly do. Young girls do it when they're posing, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, exactly.
They do that funny thing with their yeah. mouth.
So the mating moment, the bit where you're trying to send vibes to a new partner, a new mate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's just put on the pouting lip mask.
Yeah, that's what you're going to have to do, isn't it? So lippy sales must be down.
Plummeting.
Yeah.
Absolutely pointless.
Yeah.
You wouldn't even have to brush your teeth, actually, when I think about it.
Well, that's true. You wouldn't, would you? No. You could hide a whole multitude of things. You could even hide your spots.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't have to bother cleaning. No makeup.
You don't have to wipe your nose.
Most of your face a step too far.
But it is, isn't it? The whole thing about looking after your face behind a mask is quite an interesting one, isn't it? How we will not worry about certain parts of our face because we're wearing a mask.
Oh, we probably will, really.
Yeah.
Because you do have to take off. Yeah. But you know, it's just an interesting idea. But I do think expressive masks are the way to go. I've never seen any. I've been looking for them for the past couple of weeks and thinking, where are they? Why are people not doing this? A plain face mask with an expression drawn on it.
Yeah. But wouldn't you have to have a couple of face masks so that you'd have a happy, just in case
yes.
you need it, and then you'd
yes.
have to change it for a sad or a meh?
Annoyed.
Yeah.
You could have, your pockets could be full of different moods.
Yes.
Mood face masks.
Yes.
You see, when you buy them, you'd buy them in a set of five.
Mm.
You could be
happy.
Laughing, happy.
Sad.
Sad,
angry.
Annoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fed up. So depending on where you are, you could just change into them.
This could be the moment, couldn't it? This could be the moment. This will take over lipstick. And I have got lipsticks in my car, my desk, my handbag, my bathroom.
Forget that.
Yeah, it's no longer.
Forget, or just get the plain one and paint the lipstick on in a big grin. What you could do is if somebody bumped into you, as you turn around, you go, hang on a minute, and you could pull out your slightly annoyed face mask and then turn around. You'd be wearing the correct expression.
Yes, you could. Can you imagine going out for the first time with a date and you have a few face masks? And if you're getting in the conversation, if it's getting a little bit irritating, you're not really enjoying this person's...
You
would
on
literally
the bored
say,
face.
You say, excuse me, I just need to do something. You would turn your head, put your face mask on and then turn back again and say, I'm not happy.
You could go further if they were very amusing. You could have the big grin, laughing face mask with the words ha ha coming out at the side,
yes.
painted on like you were a cartoon.
Oh, and to be honest, you wouldn't have to say the words anymore. Actually, you don't even have to do it by text. You could put a face mask on. It could say,
so
you're dumb.
Lost. Yeah. That's right. I think we'd make a fortune if we start producing those face masks.
Yes.
Oh, come on, Susie, we've
yes,
got to do it.
We have.
This is a business opportunity
it is.
Not to be missed.
It is. What should we call it? Should we call it mood face masks?
Yeah, moody masks.
Moody masks! Oh, my God, that would be amazing.
Moody masks.
Moody,
just plain face masks. And we just paint expressions on. I think it'll work, Susie.
This is our moment, isn't it? I
yeah,
love the
when
one
do we
day.
Start? I suppose it'll be after your blooming boozy picnic.
My boozy picnic. Absolutely, yeah. It'd be a great moment, wouldn't it? Which mask should I have on today? Because I need to tell this person that he's fired.
He could have the grinning mask. Come in, sit down.
Yeah.
And then just sort of duck down under the desk, up again. With a serious expression mask.
Yeah.
See, I've got something really serious to talk to you
yes,
about.
Exactly.
Duck down again and bring up the your fart mask.
Yes, exactly. Oh, I love this. This sounds amazing.
Yeah, I think we'd make a fortune.
Can you imagine? I just love the whole idea of putting us...
Yeah, you could do all kinds of things for children.
Yeah.
little cartoon characters, like our cats, that kind of thing, with little noses. Why has nobody done that?
I know. Or do you know what? You wouldn't have to have Botox.
Well, no, it'd be pointless.
Because you could style, your lips yeah. the way you want them.
We could have the Botox range.
Oh, the Botox range.
With exceptionally large lips. And it'd be quite good because people could get the opportunity to see how they would look without actually having the Botox.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think there's got to be set expressions.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, for things.
To go with a mask.
Just be careful not to laugh when you've got the wrong face on, that's all.
That's right. Can you imagine? Can you imagine wearing a happy mask and you fired somebody?
You got the wrong face on.
Yeah.
I've got really, really bad news. You know, your budgie's dead.
And
why are you laughing? Yeah. I'm not laughing. You got the wrong mask on. Oh, sorry. That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd very much like to thank Professor Cecilia Mascolo and Georgina Shoshana Cohen. If you know of a woman who's making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also find us on cambridge105.co.uk or visit our website womenmakingwaves.co.uk where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.